Please join me in extending a warm welcome to our special guest tonight, Bob B. from the Summit Hill Group in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Good evening. I'm Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. For the grace of God and the power of AA, and I haven't had a drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. This is cool. I love the buzz before an AA meeting. I don't know where you get that much energy from this amount of people. You know, it is, there's more ADHD and more energy and more, there just is. It's just, I mean, it really is a buzz. You'd never, you know, if you show this to people and said everybody in the room is sober, they, you know, they would have a hard time believing that. It's nice to be here. I've been to your city a few times before, but I've never seen as much of your city as I have this time. And I'm just taken with the beauty and the, I love old, I'm in the real estate business and I've always loved architecture and love old houses and I just, it's just gorgeous. I mean, it is, you know, I think you tell the rest of the country that it rains here all the time so that more people don't move here. I have an old dear friend by the name of Lenny Z, who I went out to dinner with last night. He's not a good enough friend to be here tonight, but, you know, he's a good, one of my longtime friends. And Lenny is actually doing an auction for an AA function to help raise money for something, so. But he got sober in St. Paul. My sponsor, who has 50 years of sobriety, helped Lenny sober up. And Lenny, out of gratitude, calls every Christmas, and he came out on his own ticket and to my sponsor's 50th birthday party, and I like that. There's just this nice. I mean, it's just it's gratitude. It's you know, it's very cool. I see a lot of that in this room, and there's a lot of things. Seeing Carl, I was with Carl's brother last week in Texas, and that's nice. I think it's always difficult when two people share one personality. I think it makes it harder, you know, to go through life, but it is interesting. And then meeting Cliff's son, which is a real treat. That's nice. And I want to thank Chris and everybody else who had anything to do with this. So thanks a lot. Linda and I have had a... Would you stand up? This is my wife, Linda, and we're here together this weekend. Linda just celebrated 37 years in Al-Anon. And, so that's nice. I started drinking when I was 14. I was a freshman in high school. I was 4'11" and weighed 95 pounds. I was the second smallest kid in my high school class. Mostly mouth. I felt like everybody else got to school an hour early, held a meeting, and decided what to do for the day, and I always missed the meeting. It seemed like everybody else knew more about the business of living life than I did. I'm looking at their outsides, I'm looking at my insides, my insecurities, they look put together. And I don't know, I just wanted to belong. I was a kid, always in trouble. I was, you know, today they say I was attention deficit, then I was just a little ass. I got thrown out of grade school tens of times. And I went to a military high school on a college campus. We wore uniforms. The military was kind of a big deal. And we drank in high school like most people drink in college. We had fraternities. We drank our brains out. A couple of us almost died of alcohol poisoning. And my five closest buddies in high school, four of us are in AA and one's in Al-Anon. And then we picked each other when we were 13 before we even started drinking. So that's pretty good choices. I love drinking. We were kind of copying our parents. Our parents were those Second World War men and women who came back and they made life look really easy. They were, you know, they worked hard, played hard, had big families, were active in the community. They were just, and they had cocktail parties all the time. And we just started copying them. And I just, when I took my first drink of alcohol, I mean, I felt like I fit in. You know, I didn't feel like I was a member of the group. I felt like I owned it. I mean, it was just, it altered. And it's not a small thing. I mean, you know, it's tough to explain that to someone. It was really transformational. You know, I mean, it's There's no question about why abstinence doesn't solve that problem. It was magic. I really thought I found an answer. And I chased that as hard. By the time I finished high school, I had a reputation for having a drinking problem. I thought my drinking problem was my age. I thought, because if the police caught you or my father caught you, you were in trouble if you had one drink or 15. I never wanted to get caught with one drink, so I always had more. And I thought if I was allowed to drink like an adult, that my drinking would become normal. I had a chance to go away to school, and I did. I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. In the yearbook, class ring, you know, I was the class drunk. They used my room as a study hall. It was, you know that movie Rudy? He went to Notre Dame. I passed through. I mean, that's what happens to alcoholics. You don't get to have a life. You don't get to use your gifts, you know. So I was there. It was a big deal for me to be there, and I wasted it. You know, I remember just before the day before I left, I went down to my rector's office, and I said, I got to leave. And he's saying, don't leave. You know, God, you're a senior. And I said, no, I'm toast. I mean, I was in engineering carrying 24 credits a semester, and I hadn't been to school in 3 or 4 weeks. And it's kind of hard to bluff your way through a thermodynamics exam. And I, and he said, look, just, you can't overcome everything today. Just go upstairs and take out one book and just study for the night. And I went upstairs and I realized that I did not know what classes I had or know where they were. That's how inattentive I was in the process of my own life. You know, not an unimportant thing. And I, you know, and then there's also such a thing as karma. Linda and I have 3 children, 35, 33, and 24, and you get to experience the other side of that. You know, the middle boy, the little crap head, went to 5 colleges. He never got the concept of attending until the 3rd. You know, so you get both sides of that picture when you do that. So I left school. I was due to be commissioned as an officer. I had to get a medical release from the Army. I got a medical release for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19. That seemed nuts to me. It was just goofy. I remember I got diagnosed, and I went to the library, and I got a book on alcoholism, and it was must have been Freudian-based. It related alcoholism to latent homosexuality. And as reluctant as I was to deal with alcoholism, there were 2 issues were just overwhelming. I just couldn't deal with anything, you know. So I went back to school and drank my brains out. And I came home, finished school at a local university. When I finished school at the university, my father had a little meeting with me, and he said, Bob, he said, you got to leave house. We said, we love you. I'm 1 of 7 kids, great mom and dad, but I'm the family problem. I'm in trouble all the time. He said, you got to leave. You're just a pain in the ass. And I got a job at a liquor store, and you have to use your gifts. And I had that job for, I don't know, about 6 months, and I got fired for getting a ticket and getting in trouble. And I took a job as a waiter. I'm living on, not Skid Row, but close, $5 a night rooms. I'm shacked up with waiters and waitresses, and you know, Dr. Seuss, that child author, those are actual photographs of people I live with during the last year of my drinking. And I'm getting up in the morning, I'm drinking a couple of beers, I'm going to work. I work from 10 to 2. From 2 to 5, I go drink beer. At 5, I go buy a pint, and then I figure out where I'm going to live. I do that for 6 or 7 months. I go to a party one night. I get my face kicked in. I don't quite remember why that happened, but I got fired because they didn't want me serving food looking the way I looked. And I was tapped. I had no place to go, and I went back to my home, and they hadn't seen me in 6 months or so, and I asked if I could move back in the house, and on the condition that I wouldn't drink, they allowed me back in the house. And when I moved back in the house, if you would have asked my father what he wanted for me and got me in a separate room and asked me what I wanted for me, the answers would have been very close to the same. You never could have convinced my family that what I wanted for me was anything like what they wanted for me. It looked like I was hell-bent for destruction. It looked like I didn't care about anything. I was lied between a sister who did graduate work at the Sorbonne and a brother who was Phi Beta Kappa in law school, and I'm this crap head lodged between these two show-offs. And when I moved back in the house, I really tried to change my life. I really tried to get it back on track. I got a job as an executive trainee in a manufacturing concern. I bought my first car. I got back together with Linda, who we had gone with for a year and then broken up with, and we became engaged and married. I thought if I could get a woman in my life, that would make a real difference, you know. And I started, you know, so I said, I'm finally going to become an adult. I finally got some structure. So I go to, now I'm the company drunk. I go to, corporations are tough places for alcoholics. They like to have you come in on Mondays and stay on Fridays, and they've got lunch hours, and it's just, I'm using up my sick leave in the first 3 months, and I'm falling asleep at my desk, and it's just not working. And I quit that job at about 5 months, I think. I took a sales job, thought that would give me more flexibility. And I had the sales job about, I don't know, a couple of months, and a buddy of mine got married, and weddings were always good for about a week. And I woke up one Thursday afternoon in July of 1967, and I hadn't been to work in 3 days, and I hadn't called in. And it was just one of those, like someone jump-started my heart. You know, you kind of come to rather than wake up. And I didn't know if I had a job, a fiancé, or a place to live, and I was just panicked. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my father, that my psychiatrist that I call AA, didn't seem like such an impossible thing, and I called AA. And after I called, I found out I had a job, a fiancé, and a place to live, and I thought, why the hell did you call AA? That's kind of a kind of an overreaction, don't you think? And but I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like, so I made an appointment. So I went, and I met these two guys at a cafe. And when you're young and in trouble, you get put in front of a lot of people who try to help. My parents, as Linda and I tried to help the kids, my parents have, all three of our sons are in AA, 17 years of sobriety, 14 years of sobriety, and 6 years of sobriety. And we've been, you know, I think my wife's a carrier. I've turned her into New York, but none of us were alcoholic when we met her. And So I'd been in front of judges and attorneys and doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs and everybody trying to help me. You're usually the subject of the conversation, but not a participant in the conversation. And I went and met these two guys, and I didn't know what to expect. But I met a guy. One guy had 6 months. One guy had 6 years. And they sat me down in a booth at a cafe, and they said, you know, we're from AA. We had a drinking problem. We found an answer in AA, and we're going to share it with you. And we hope it's, you know, helps you. But for some reason, it doesn't matter because it helps us maintain our sobriety. And they sat me down and they told me, you know, they weren't getting the toaster for signing me up. It wasn't a multi-level marketing deal. It was just a 12-step call. And they told me their stories. And in the sharing of their lives with me, they changed my life. That night, my life changed. We have many traditions in AA. I think one of the most wonderful ones of which is that we share our experience, our strength, and our hope rather than our ideology or our philosophy or our knowledge. You know, that doesn't come from our head, it comes from our heart. And those two men, I found myself sharing stuff with them that I hadn't shared with any helper that had tried to help me. I'd never talked to another person who had a drinking problem. I talked to experts about the problem, but I'd never talked to anybody with the problem. And that night I went to my first meeting of AA. I drank twice after that night, once with about 30 days of sobriety and a business trip to the West Coast. I was told to call AA, and I didn't, and I got drunk. I came back, and then I had almost 3 months of sobriety, and Linda and I were married, and I drank on our honeymoon, which I think subconsciously I always kind of planned to do. And we honeymooned in Mexico, and you know where the divers dive off those cliffs in Mexico? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. I could do that. And I was pretty loaded, and I went over and introduced myself to Alemán, the ex-president of Mexico. His nephew had been my roommate 1 year, and his bodyguards are all upset. I am drunk. And so I dive off the public landing. I climb up the cliff. I get up to about 85 or 90 feet. I split my swimsuit. I cut my leg. I'm stuck. Linda's going absolutely nuts. She said she had this premonition about Minnesotan brought home in a bag, you know, and I am... You know, and it's tough to climb down. I mean, I'm stuck. I'm up here now, and all these people, and I'm watching the waves, and I'm trying to figure out whether to jump or dive, and finally I said, ah, screw it, and I dove. And God watches after fools and drunks because I made it. And There's an old-timer named by the name of Norm Alp, and he talks about seconds and inches. But for seconds and inches, this room might be empty. But for the car accidents, the overdoses, the prisons, you know, if I would have jumped, I would have died. You can't get out. You have to get out almost 30 feet to hit the middle of the channel. I didn't know that. You can't jump and get out far enough. You know, if I knew it, I knew it intuitively, not didactically. And after those years, we started vacationing down there, and we had the kids down there on our 10th anniversary, and Linda and I were watching the divers one night about midnight, and she gave me a picture of the chasm at Lochaber, and on the bottom it said, "But for the grace of God." And I said, "God, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done." And she said, "Bob, it's not even in the top 10." I don't know how you can share life with someone and see it so differently. A few years back, I was gaining some weight, and I decided I better get in shape. And I said to her, I said, "I need to get in shape. I think I'm going to buy a bike." And she said, "Good idea." And I bought a Harley, and she was not pleased at all. So, I mean, there's just little communication issues So I came back. I was embarrassed to go back to the group. Linda said, "Oh, for God's sake, call Warren." I am blessed with the same sponsor that I had when I walked in the front door. My sponsor has 50 years of sobriety. His wife was Linda's sponsor, and he's just been perfect for me. He was a mailman, and he later worked in the field of alcoholism, but he was a mailman when I asked him to be my sponsor. And everything that I've had the privilege of doing in AA, I just kind of got because I followed Warren around and did what he recommended I do and did what he kind of did. So when I got given talks because I got taken to the prisons and the jails and other AA groups, and I got active as a sponsor because Warren was the champion 12-step caller and sponsor in our group, and it's a nice deal. He wasn't feeling very good. I was going to try to get him out to see Lenny, but he's 85 and he's not... doesn't travel as easily as he used to. So now I'm back in AA. I'm 24. I just turned 24. And I can remember when I walked in the first meeting of AA, I didn't know what to expect. And I was welcomed wonderfully. I was pretty young. 23 wasn't, you know, what was showing up in those days as much. After that, we started to have a lot of treatment. We started to get younger people. But I was the youngest guy in that group. But for one, for almost 2 years. I remember when I came in, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought what everybody was telling me is I had a drinking problem. If I quit drinking, I'd be okay. Well, just before I went back to my senior year, I got in trouble and I was beaten and up and rolled and pistol whipped and shot at and thrown out of the second story of a hotel. And I ended up in a hospital in the psych ward, and they weren't going to let me go back to school, but I talked my way out of it. I went back to school, and I stayed sober for 3 months. And I didn't instantaneously become what I thought you were telling me I'd become if I just wouldn't drink. I didn't become a model kid or a better student. My life was not more comfortable. Contrary, it was more uncomfortable. And I thought I proved that I could quit whenever I wanted to because I was pretty much a daily drinker, and I just quit. And number two, that booze was not my problem because I just quit and my problems didn't go away. Booze was my answer. It wasn't my problem. It was my friend. I had a noise in my head. I don't know why I had the noise in my head. It's like I had an amplifier that was turned up to around 9, and when I took 3 or 4 drinks, it went down to about 4. And there was a sense of comfort. There was a sense of ease that I didn't get readily in any other way. And it was a friend. And then a friend turned on me, and I didn't know what to do about it. I just couldn't understand it. The trouble, when I first started getting in trouble, it was worth it. There wasn't any issues. And then you start donating, you know, more and more and more and more, and then it gets to a spot where, you know, it's about even, and then it gets well past even, and you got to look at giving it up, and you give it up, and you get sober for a while, and it's not an answer. And so you really think, you take a look at it, and you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And that's how I showed up to AA. I remember my sponsor sat me down in a chair. He said, "Bob, alcoholism is threefold, physical, mental, and spiritual." He said, "Once you take once you pass the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time, when you drink and when you don't drink." Now, the idea that my alcoholism could affect me when I wasn't drinking was like rocket science. That was like an idea that had not occurred to me. I mean, it was a brand new idea. He said, well, we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, once we take our last drink of alcohol and our last drug, we use the 12 steps of the recovery program to change, to find a different way to live that's sufficiently better so that we don't have to go back to drugs or booze, for us to do something for us that we were unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. If you don't change, if you don't find in sobriety what you're looking for in a bottle, you're not going to stay because you don't know how to live sober. That was like the Gettysburg Address. I can remember the chair I was sitting in. That was 37 and a half years ago. I remember the chair I was sitting in when he told me those words. So I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, okay, I'll buy it. I got the problem. You got the answer. And if I got the problem and you got the answer, I got about a half a dozen other issues that are going on in my life. And if you've got the answer, you got to be able to heal those. And it might take a year. Yeah. Didn't go away in a year, and they haven't totally gone away in 35 years. I had ordinary but difficult, you know, I just had living problems. I had trouble getting up in the morning. I later found out that it had something to do with when I went to bed, but I did not know that at that time. I had work problems. I had trouble getting to work. I had trouble staying at work. I had some difficulty working at work. Other than that, I was a pretty good worker. And I had money problems. I spent about $300 more a month than I made in 1967. If you do that over a long period of time, you end up in debt. I just want to report that to you, just in case you're running that one and you don't know where it goes. And we started our family. We had two boys at that time, and I had great parents, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the few mistakes that my parents did, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made and a bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent with my children. I'm not proud of that fact, but that's an accurate description of how I was with my parenting. And I had a gambling problem, more of a hobby. 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It wasn't a big deal, and it was, but I was making about $5 to $10 grand a year playing backgammon, so it was kind of like a second job. And I had all those issues in my first year of sobriety and never noticed them. They were not on my inventory. My first inventory I took when I was sober about 2 months. And it was kind of a recitation of the worst things I had done in my life. I mean, I had read the book. I tried to do the best job I knew how to do. And I did what I did. I experienced a lot of relief in doing my first fifth step. It just wasn't horribly insightful into the causes and conditions in my life. But it was forgiving, and it was important. So I didn't have a very good list of defects of character in my first year, but I started to get a pretty good list during my second year. I was on a honeymoon during my first year. I was this grace period where I just, you know what I was looking for in AA? I was looking for someone who knew Bob so well that they could look through my soul and tell me what was going on in my life. Because I was lost. I thought I just had a built-in failure mechanism. It seemed like I was reasonably well-equipped. I was a great starter, but I couldn't finish anything. I just wanted someone to tell me why. I never found that. What happened to me is I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I took the first step and I surrendered. And when I surrendered, I became an alcoholic. And when I became an alcoholic, I had about 20 to 40 people who could teach me because they knew a lot about alcoholism. And I'd ask them questions, and they'd give me an answer, and I had an answer. About the time I was a year sober, my ego started to reassert itself, and I'd start to ask you a question, and you'd give me an answer, and then I wasn't sure you were right. And I started looking for the expert on Bob again. And from my second to fifth year, I was kind of still looking for the expert on Bob, the person who really seemed to understand me rather than the disease as much. And one by one, my defects of character came into my vision, and one by one, I kind of cataloged them. And I took them on, and I tried to deal with them with my program. And I make a little progress, but not much. They bothered me during my third year. They started eating my lunch in my fourth and fifth year. In my sixth and seventh year, I was really in trouble. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about problems in sobriety. Now, I know that most of you don't have problems in sobriety. But mine's kind of a sad case. And And I'm 7 years sober, and I'm at the meeting, and a new guy come in with that bushel basket full of manure, and we'd sit down, we'd have a cup of coffee, and he'd tell me about the trouble he was in, and we'd chat, and I'd say, hey, as bad as it is and as hopeless as it seems, I'm glad you're here and you're in the right place. I know you don't know how this is going to work out, but if you get in this program and you get into the book and you just try the steps, you don't have to do them perfectly, just get into them and start working them. Get a sponsor, get into the book and go to meetings. Your life's going to be just fine. You see that guy over there? God, 3 years ago he was a mess, and today he's just fine. And I'd get in the car at 11 o'clock at night, and I'd go home, and I'd say, Bob, when are you going to be fine? You're 5 years sober. You just charged a $400 sport coat at a store that you had a $700 bill at. When are you going to stop buying things you don't need with money you don't have to impress people you don't like? I'm driving down, that's Cecil, by the way. I stole it. And I'm driving home, and I think, when are you going to learn how to work? You don't know how to work. I mean, I'm a salesman. I'm supposed to be selling, and I'm just phoning up reports. I don't want to even make a call on the off chance that you drag me across the desk and force me to sell you something. I'm just, hiding out, playing backgammon. I go to work and, just as lame as you could get. And when are you going to be gentler with the kids and nicer to your wife? And when are you going to quit gambling? And I didn't know, because I'm trying to not do all these things, and I'm doing them regularly, not monthly, not quarterly. I'm doing them daily. And I'm now starting to sponsor people. I'm starting to give AA talks. I'm doing the steps. I really am trying to do it. But what had happened is you just kind of got me well enough to be disgusted with myself. I mean, that's what it seemed like. It seemed like I'm on the down escalator going up. It seemed like, so I'm as unhappy with myself at 6 or 7 years of sobriety as I was when I walked in the front door. And I knew what the answer was. I had great teachers. The two things that have kept me in AA is my big mouth, because I usually end up talking about what's going on in my life, and the fact that I've been attracted to teachers. And I've been attracted to the older members of AA in whom the waters ran deep. And they had a dimension of spirituality and faith that I didn't have. But the problem was, I go knock on the door, and God says, who's there? And I say, God, it's Bob. And he says, what do you want? And I said, oh, I want to turn myself in. Christ, I'm 7 years sober. My pants are on fire. I need some help. And God's going to say, fine. And then I'm going to say what all of us say when we go over and turn ourselves in. What do I do? Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what God's going to tell me to do. Get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. Get on a budget. That's an Al-Anon word. I think for AAs, I think that's a harsh word for alcoholics. And stop gambling. Be kind and loving to your children and to your wife. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what your higher power might want of you with my list of character defects if you would go turn yourself in. And I thought, what's the use of turning yourself in to try to develop a deeper relationship with your higher power if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? And I was stuck in that place for almost 3 years. I figured, as soon as I clean my act up, I'll go turn myself in. But it's not used to turn myself in now. And finally, at about... it was about the time of the International at Denver. Your dad was sick, and I was just a basket case. I'm thinking about suicide. Not drinking. But I'm thinking about suicide. Isn't that cool? Mr. AA. And so finally, out of desperation, I went back to the steps, 8 years sober. I mean, it wasn't very hard to figure out step one. I was clearly, obviously, powerless and unmanageable in my sobriety. You know the step that fooled me? Step two. I believe step two for us. I could have put my hand on a lie detector, and if you would have said, do you believe God's going to restore us to sanity? I'd say yes. Needle would not move. Now ask me if I think God's going to restore Bob to sanity. No, I don't. Because I'm 8 years sober. I'm busting my britches. I'm going to 5 meetings a week. I'm sponsoring guys. I'm trying to do the steps. I'm... you know, I'm a pretty good member of AA. I'm really care about how I live my life. I'm going backwards. Now, when you're in trouble, you either get more or less active. I got a little bit more active, and I started to see people with bigger problems, with smiles on their faces, with great dignity, walking through walls that I was trying to avoid. And I started to believe, again, that God would restore me to sanity. I got down on my knees. I took the third step. We didn't do that in Minnesota in those days. But I had, by this time, started going to conferences. And I started to hear people talk about taking it with someone else. And I, you know, did it with my sponsor. And I got down on my knees to just take the third step prayer. And then I did a fourth step, I had done. And I, the previous fifth steps I had done with clergy, which was our custom. And this one I did with my sponsor. And I said, you know, be careful, because when you're done, I'm going to do whatever you recommend that I do. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I said, if you gave me a test and told me what to, and asked me what to do, I could tell you what to do. I just can't do it. And I said, I think I'm ready to do it. And we did my fifth step, and we talked a little bit. One of the things he wanted me to do was go to a psychologist. I didn't want to do that, but I promised that I would, and I didn't. I had a lot of issues around failure, around money. My father was a pretty successful guy, and I thought I'll never be as good as my old man, and, you know, issues like that. And I was afraid of a number of things. So I went. I called up the psychologist. And he said, will you get your parents involved? I said, no. I said, my parents have been over-involved in my life. And I said, if you can't help me without getting my parents involved, could you recommend me to someone who can? He said, will you get your wife involved? I thought, oh, crap. Well, they see it so differently. It's sometimes more accurately. Then he wanted my kids involved. I did not want my kids involved because I was ashamed of how I was occasionally with my children. But I said, okay. So I started going to the psychologist, and we get into the deal, and we're into it, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks, and we're in the room, Linda and I and Billy and Peter. And my, I'm in the real estate investment business, and I'm going broke. And I don't know why. I'm busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day, and it's just not working. And and the company's about to go down, and he looked at me and he said, why are you so afraid of failing? And I wanted to punch him in the mouth. And I said to him, look, you're a doctor. I said, you fail, you file bankruptcy, you just take your little sign, walk down the hall, pound it on another door, and you're making $100,000 within 6 months. I said, I'm in the real estate investment business and I'm about to go bankrupt and I'm going to lose everything I had. I said, nod your head up and down if you understand that. I'm going to lose everything I have. And he looked at my wife, and he said, Linda, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? And my wife said, no, wouldn't lose me. He asked the boys, who were pretty young, if your father lost everything he had, would he lose you? And the boys said, no, wouldn't lose us. If you can't lose, you can't play. Now, I'm the guy that when we get a, you know, if we were going to run a marathon, I'd have a great pair of tennis shoes, a good pair of shirts. I'd look and talk and act like a runner. I'd tell you that I won some race in Minnesota. And you'd expect that I would be in the top 10 in the race. And when the race took off, I'd be in the top 10 for about the first third or half of the race. But somewhere between 40 and 60% of the race, I'd fall down, hurt myself, and I wouldn't finish the race. When the race is over, someone would say, gee, what happened to that guy from Minnesota? It's a hell of a guy. Won some race in Minnesota. He must have pulled a hamstring or something, you know. But if you would have followed me around in a helicopter in my life for the preceding 5 years, you could have guessed within 50 feet when I would have fallen down and hurt myself, because I don't finish anything. And it gets old. It gets old. It gets old not being able to use our gifts. Most of us have our gifts still under the piano, still wrapped up with the red bow on top of them. We never get it out of the package to even find out what our gifts are, much less use them in our lives. That's a pretty big price to pay in our lives. And you get tired of hurting the people you care about, letting the people down. You get tired of the looks in the eyes. You get tired of potential. You get tired of throwing a hand grenade in your life every 6 months just to see what the hell it would look like. You know, I mean, it is. And you know the discovery I made? Is how afraid I was. Now, I had done 3 inventories. And fear had to do with dogs and snakes and high buildings. I had no insight into my fears. And what I found out is I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of success. I was afraid of marriage. I was afraid of being a parent. I was afraid of putting it on the line and finding out. I got liking that you'd assume that if I ever put it on the line and really did it, that I'd be good. Rather than putting it on the line and finding out how I'd be if I put it on the line. Okay? I was the guy in the football team that had the uniform. I did the calisthenics. I did the locker room. But when they blew the whistle to block and tackle, I didn't block and tackle. I went up in the stands. The trouble with life is there are no stands. There is no place to hide. And that was an enormous discovery for me. Not too long after that, I was in my living room and I had one of the worst days in AA that I had had. I left work early and got in a backgammon game. I won about $600. I missed work. I missed dinner. I missed AA. Came home, got in a fight with my wife, and slapped one of the kids. One of the nights you'd like to have videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do for you. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, it happened again. Weren't you there? I'd say, well, yeah, I was there, but it's like I wasn't there. I mean, it's like it's so habitual. It's like I don't even have to think about what I'm doing. It's like it's automatic. It's like I'm in a blackout. And all of a sudden, I realized that was a bunch of crap. I wasn't in a blackout. It wasn't automatic. My life was that way because I designed it that way. I sounded like I wanted to quit gambling. I wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble for as much money as I wanted to gamble and not have problems because of gambling. I wanted money without work. I wanted my wife's and children affection without spending time with them. Not a very good design. And all of a sudden, I realized that I had tried as hard as I knew how to try to change those things in AA. And for whatever reason, a thought came to me that maybe that's where you're supposed to be. And I was given the opportunity to take the 6th and the 7th step of AA. The 6th step said that we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. And the 7th step said that we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I had spent 6 or 8 years trying to get rid of them. I don't have the power to get rid of them. I'm the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. And that night, out of fear of getting drunk, but mostly out of fear of being a horse's ass, sober horse's ass, I got down on my knees and took the 6th and the 7th step, and 4 of the major problems of my life disappeared that night. Such as the power of the program of AA and the power of the 6th and the 7th step. A doctor doesn't heal. He creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed, creates a fertile environment, creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place, and God grows. And we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes us. It's an atmosphere, I think, of the 6th and the 7th step. I think it's an atmosphere of being honest, open-minded, and being willing. When we talk about change, most of us want to change. But I knew, I'm a guy that when I go on a diet, I go buy a quart of ice cream and a bag of cookies. Well, it's already been a bad day. I'm just going to finish the day off, and I'm probably never going to have ice cream again. So And I realized that I had made a lot of promises to myself and hadn't been able to keep them. And for some reason, I knew that I needed a structure of support. So I did 3 or 4 things to help ensure that I would. I turned my checkbook over to my wife, and I went on an allowance. I gave her my paycheck. She had a set of financial trouble in about 9 months. She had this technique where she could pay a third of a bill. Damnedest thing I have ever... I thought if you paid a third of a bill, they wouldn't think you had the money. And she didn't have the issues of ego around money that I had. I started dating my wife every Friday night for about the next 25 years. I took Linda out every Friday. It was a real live, dangerous date. No one else went out with us. We got dressed up. We went out. By this time, we had two kids, and we were always talking about money and bills and kids. That wasn't how we fell in love. So we had to kind of get the romance back and go shack up someplace and get, you know, we'd get some action going. But you did. I mean, we had to do the sorts of things you do if you were courting someone to get, you know, to get enjoying each other again, which is an important thing to do. And that's been a very important. I spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better parent. I think being a parent takes 125% of whatever you got. Having kids is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. It is a demanding. I really think that it's as demanding a process as can possibly be. And I quit gambling that night. All of a sudden, the guy that didn't know how to work could work well. I made an appointment with my sponsor about when I'd go to work and when I'd stay at work. And I was selling investments in real estate. My partner and I have a partner who's 41 years sober. We've been partners for 33 years in the real estate business. And I remember I was sitting out in a parking lot of a major corporation going to go call an executive to try to sell him an investment for 15 grand. And I'm afraid to get out of the car. And so I have a big book in the car. So I read the third step prayer. Now, for whatever reason, what I did is I started to making sales calls an AA activity. For whatever reason, as I would do the AA things, I wouldn't do work things. So all of a sudden, I decided that work was an AA activity. And I decided I had to go make this damn sales call. And I read this prayer, and I went up there, made this sales call that I knew wouldn't work. And the guy bought the investment, and I made $1,000 in that hour meeting. And I remember on the way back to the car, I thought, God, you know, if a guy did that regularly, in the next 10 years, everything I touched turned to gold. I made enough money to burn a wet elephant, and I bought the big house and bought, you know, two Mercedes, a big one and a little one, and those are my deeply shallow period. And you know, there's problems with failure, but there's problems with success. There was an arrogance that crept in that I was invisible to me. I'm the guy in the fancy suit and the $100 tie driving up to the meeting in his Mercedes, thinking God has blessed him because of what a great program he had. How would you like to have been in my group? You know, and then in 1986, I'll just finish the story quickly because I got something else I want to focus on. So for 10 years, it was wonderful. And then in 1986, they passed the Tax Act. From 1986 to 1991, I went broke. I lost $8 million in 4 years. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. I lost everything I had. Losing the money was not like changing clothes. It was like tearing the skin off my body. I went to I asked a man to be my spiritual advisor, and he said, what do you want? I said, I want to be more loving and less materialistic. Within about 6 weeks, I started to lose everything I had. And I went to him, and I said, we have to talk. I said, what I really meant was I'd like to keep the things and be less materialistic. We joke about that today. I don't think God had the real estate collapse to teach me a lesson, but within each of the world's experiences, there is a lesson for each of us to learn. And I had to learn who I was with money and who I was without money. And that was the experience I had to have to learn what I learned during that time. Today, I would not take the money for the lesson. I'd take the money and the lesson, but my biggest fear during that period of time is that God was going to make me rich, poor, and happy. That's not a joke. I mean, I really thought that. Peter, our middle boy, came back from college, and he got in a car accident, totaled out the car, got arrested for drunken driving, ended up in detox. It was kind of his Christmas present to his mother and I. And and he's in a halfway house, and we'd go to the meeting at the halfway house. I'm 25 years sober, 23 years sober, 22. And when the meeting would start, I'd start crying. I'd cry all the way through the meeting. This is the kid that I was nose to nose with. This is the kid that was the most most like me and the most challenging for me. And can't you just see the guys at the meeting and say, see that guy over there? He's got 23 years. How'd you like to have what he has? You know, I think I think he's got the clap. I'm not sure what's on it. And but you get more active or less active. But if you're going to be in AA a long time, if you're going to be married a long time, if you're going to be a child a long time, if you're going to have children a long time, if you're going to be in your community a long time, you're going to have ups and downs. You are not going to be immune. You're going to have your time in the barrel. You're going to have tough times, and we are not immune from that. We are not immune from problems. The program doesn't promise us immunity from problems. It promises us a spiritual strength and a way to deal with the problems. And I've climbed my way back out of that hole, and today I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. I'm in love with my wife, and I got a good relationship with my boys. That boy that was in the halfway house is in England today getting an MBA at Oxford. And I always thought if he ended up at Oxford, it would have been the prison in Mississippi, not the... If I were to ask us in the group, you know, I mean, mostly what I try to do in AA is clean my act up and have my life be okay. I want to be happy. And I want to do the right thing. I want to be a good man. I had a great deal of difficulty doing that in my early sobriety. And I felt terribly bad about being 6 or 7 or 8 years sober and having the living problems that I had. I clearly expected that if I got into the steps and I did the things, that my life would have come in order much sooner than that. And I think some of the problems I had was because of chronology. I was young. I was immature. I mean, but I'll tell you one thing. You don't get it all done in a year. I don't care who you are. You don't get it done in 2 years. And I'll tell you, the experience I had between, 5 and 15 years of sobriety, I think if most real alcoholics are going to have their pants on fire sometime between 5 and 15 years of sobriety. I think most of us come in with a lot of immediate, heavy, difficult problems, and we've got an agenda that we want to deal with, and we get active in the program, and we are amazingly successful at dealing with that agenda in the first 2 or 3 years of our sobriety. But there's a bunch of things we don't even have on our list. We don't even know we should have on our list. The causes and conditions. I mean, it's a physical, mental, and spiritual disease. The physical part's gone, but the mental and spiritual part's not gone. The disease of alcoholism is still there. So I mean, there was a time that I thought I might have to go to Gamblers Anonymous or Spenders Anonymous. Or God, if I had to go to a program for every problem I had, I would have been a busy kid, I'll tell you. But another way of looking at that is that was the expression. Most of us have issues. I think when we get rid of our drinking was a distraction and a way for us to drop out. It was a way for us not to have to attend to life. We had trouble living life on life's terms. We found a medication, we found a drug, we found a way to not have to deal with life on life's terms, and it worked until it didn't work. And then we had to stop. And when we stopped, we had to face ourselves and the reason that we were walking around drinking a pint a day or a fifth a day or whatever the hell we were drinking. What was wrong with us? And you don't even find that out in the first year. You start to get a sense of it, I think, around the third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh year. How does it show up? It shows up in your relationships. If God wants to get a message to you, how's he going to get it to you? Bad news, probably through your spouse. that's harsh, I think, but or your kids, or your boss, or your creditor. Okay? My first 2 years in AA, I tried to change my life and I failed. I tried and failed, I tried and failed, I tried and failed, but I still grew. But there comes a time in AA where you've got to change or you stop growing. You just know too much. There comes a time where you have to fish or cut bait. And at that point in time, when you hit that point in the road, you either start changing or you start building an addition onto your house to accommodate the problem. Chasers hang out with the chasers. Gamblers hang out with the gamblers. And you make a deal. I won't call you on your crap. You don't call me on mine. We'll talk about the steps, traditions, and meetings. You stay out of my face. I'll stay out of yours. Deal? Bad deal. Changing is not easy. I assumed that I wanted to change. I was conflicted. I wanted to. Part of me wanted to change, but I was scared to death of changing. I didn't know. And it wasn't like I was a bad guy. I was an unskillful guy. I mean, we all show up in life, and what do? We start building our little toolkit. You start at 3 years old, you're building your toolkit, trying to figure out, you're just trying to fit in, trying to survive, trying to excel or trying to succeed or trying to get by. Well, most of us show up in Alcoholics Anonymous with a toolkit full of hammers. No other tools, just hammers, you know, just... When your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I just want to report that to you. Okay? Now, all we're trying to do is to avoid pain and to have happiness in our lives. We're just not skilled at it. So the universe is trying to get the message to us, and the message is it's not working. They get the message to us through the relationships in our lives and through the inventory and the program. You start to get a handle. And how do we change? Having had a spiritual awakening, what happens to us is over a period of time, we become more awake. I have the same weaknesses today. The tendency to spend money. I have a tendency to anger. I'm a little overweight. You probably haven't noticed that. But I hide it well. And you don't get rid of all your issues. But they don't control you the way they used to control you. I was a monkey on a string. I was a jukebox. You put a quarter in me and you push B5, I'm going to play B5. Okay, you want to dance? Let's dance. Okay? Today, you put a quarter in me and you push B5 and I get to choose whether we play B5. I never had that choice in my life. I had a thought reaction, thought reaction, thought reaction. I get an idea, it was glued on my eyeball. There was no other reality. That thought, when I engaged it, Frank Miles used to talk about it, you know, the Grand Central Station mind. There's lots of trains. You don't have to get on every train that goes through the station. You can actually watch the train come in. You can watch the train go out. You do not have to. As funny as that is, when I would have those thoughts, they would almost like overtake me. They would be my reality. Today, I am not my thoughts. I am not the thinker of my thoughts. We act like we generate our own thoughts. You think you generate your own thoughts? Try stopping them. Okay, how many, you know, for the people in this room who have tried meditation, most of us know you don't generate your own thoughts. You are flooded with thoughts. The best you can do is let them pass through like clouds in the sky. You cannot stop that flow. You can stop paying attention to it. Okay, you cannot give it so much power. But you can't generally stop it. So I started to have a gap, a space. The thought was no longer pasted on my eyeball. I'd get it out here and I'd go, wow, haven't had a crazy thought like that in a while. And I started to have a choice in my life that you gave me through inventory, through the first step, through the second step, through the third step. One of the great things about change that I, you know, we read an awful lot about the promises in the book, and that's one of my, I enjoy the promises, but I think one of the most powerful things in the book is right after the promises, and on the bottom of page 84, and we're talking about change, we're talking about, do you want to change? And I say we're conflicted, that most of we want to change, but we're afraid of change, and that was what was wrong with me. For the longest time, I didn't know how afraid of changing I was. I thought those character defects were me. Okay, when we're talking about change, we're not talking, it isn't muscle and bone. You know, it is not us. It is our behavior. It is not who we are. It is what we do. to one of my favorite things in the book at the bottom of page 84, and it says we've ceased fighting anything or anybody for, but this time, now we're talking about having done the first nine steps. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We're seldom interested in liquor. Let's talk for a minute about my gambling problem. I'm seldom interested in gambling. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We find that this has happened automatically. Does that sound like I did it? Does it sound like my muscle, my body, my intellect did it? It's happened automatically. We see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given to us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it. We're not avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. So I put myself in a position. I surrender. I get into the steps. Today there's more teaching about the steps than there ever has been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's terrific. Today we use the book more than we ever think that's terrific. But there's some mischief in that. Some of us are starting to use the book like the real hard-ass Christians use the Bible. We're starting to beat each other up with the book. We're starting to act like, you know, I know people that have the first 164 pages memorized. I wouldn't go on a fishing trip with them. Okay. You know, got the menu memorized and they're starving to death. Okay. The steps are not mechanical. If the steps are mechanical, every time you had a problem, you just click your heels and say the third step prayer and you'd be back in Kansas. Okay. The steps are spiritual. They're of God. Because they're of God, no one owns them. They are much greater than they first appear if you were just... Because if they, now, and don't get me wrong, there are times when I take the steps mechanically. Doing them mechanically is better than not doing them. And sometimes it's all you got. Sometimes you go say the third step prayer, no one's home, but you still say it. You still, those are practices, those are ideas. So don't get me wrong, that you, there's lots of times you do them poorly because that's all you got at that moment. You go with what you got at the moment. And you keep attending to the practice that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. But because they're not mechanical, there's some place, the process of recovery and the process of change in the program is more transformational than it is linear. It isn't just a process of doing, it's a process of altering who we be. When you start altering who you be, what you do automatically changes. So there's a way of bringing ourselves in that process. And do I know what that is? I don't. I know it from my experience, and because it's kind of godlike, you just can't contain it in words. You can't snap your fingers and describe it. When that person comes over to your house at night and they're dying, you know, they're dying. Every once in a while I say, okay, quiet. Pretend I came to your house and just had that same half-hour conversation with you. What would you tell me to do? They always know. They always know. They can't do it, but they know. Okay. We're not short on knowing. We're short. We're lacking the power to do it. We have to get out of the way. So what's the answer? Surrender. But how do you tell someone how to surrender? That's not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing. You can, in a conversation, point to it, you know. But as some people say, when the master points to the moon, all the idiot sees is the finger. It is not easy to take these deep concepts and codify them. So there's a way of being in the process of the steps. There's a humility, an honesty, an openness, a willingness, some surrender. There's a way of being in that process, and when we open ourselves up, we get changed. And what I've discovered in my life, and the reason I'm 30 pounds overweight, is I'm conflicted. I'd like to look like Brad Pitt, but I'd like to eat like, you know, an asshole. It is. Sorry, that was the only word that came to mind. You know. It is. No, but it's funny. There are days I can't even pray about it because I'm not ready. You know. There are other days where I can. There are periods of my life where I can order certain things in my life, and there are periods of my life where I've not been particularly successful at doing it. I can't summon my willingness automatically and snap my fingers because I don't own it. But I'm involved in a process today that gives me access to spiritual principles. It gives me a set of tools. It gives me a community. It gives me a place to go to sit down in a meeting with 15 or 20 other people that may not like me, but they care about how my life is and they want it better for me. That's what an asset that is. Okay? And it works. It's not a half answer. It's not about abstinence. It's about finding something to treat the mental, the physical, the spiritual, and emotional aspects of our disease. Is to find a way to have us find in sobriety what we're looking for in a bottle. Thank you for my life.